Well, I've told a few of you this, but our newest chapter is in Hagerstown, Maryland. And that's dear to my heart because when I was a little boy, that's where I bought all my scientific gear. It was the cheapest place to buy scientific stuff, a place called Edmund Scientific. So some of you remember that, all right?
Edmund Salvage Company.
Well, you know a little bit about my story. For 9 years, I collected beer bottles and pop bottles. There was a lot of drunks in our neighborhood, so there was a lot of beer bottles you could collect. Each one was worth 1.5 cents, and empty soda pop bottles were worth 2 cents. And after about 7 years, I had enough of those collected that I was able to buy a mirror from Edmund Scientific, and with my father's help, built my first telescope.
Is that still around?
I think it's still around, but now it's called Edmund Science Salvage Company.
That was in the 40s when they started, in the 50s, it was Edmund Salvage Company, selling war surplus options.
Right, right. Well, I got some of that war surplus stuff, so that was good. But, we meet regularly with our chapters through Skype, so I had a Skype meeting with a bunch of our chapter people in Hagerstown. They told me the story of how the first meeting they had, there was this young woman and young man that came into the group and was apologetics at first sight. But after about 6 months of attending those apologetics meetings, they got engaged and now they're getting ready to get married. So the joke at that meeting was, we're now competing with eHarmony. So but I posted a photo of a rainbow, the brightest rainbow I've ever seen, and it's really spectacular. But predictably what happened, as soon as I got it posted on my Facebook page, I got all these questions from people, was Noah the first one to see rainbows? Well, if you've been in the class long enough, you know that Noah was not the first one to see rainbows. But I thought I'd put it back to you. I mean, I get this question a lot, so I want to make sure you can all answer it. There's two reasons why Noah was not the first to see rainbows. And you can get that just by looking at the book of Genesis. Anybody got a clue? Two reasons why Noah was not the first to see rainbows.
No windows on the ark?
No windows on the ark?
It rained before the flood.
There was rain before the flood. And where do you get that?
Genesis.
We've got a theologian in a class here. I knew he would know the answer. But yeah, in Genesis 2, it actually contrasts rain with mist. So the very fact that you see these two Hebrew words for rain, and by the way, the words edmatar simply refer to water coming down out of the sky. In one case, the drops are large. In the other case, the drops are tiny. And depending where you are in the Middle East area, the size of the tiny drops would vary. And you've heard me say this before, where I grew up in British Columbia, we call it a mist if the drops of rain were less than 3/16 of an inch in diameter. It had to be bigger than that before we called it rain. But I'm sure that in the Persian Gulf area, they were talking about drops that were probably less than a 32nd inch. But the whole point is this. If any of you have watered your lawn, you've seen this. Even when the drops are really, really tiny, like a 64th of an inch, you will get a rainbow. And, of course, you'll get a rainbow with rain. And so Adam, I think, was seeing rainbows. And people all the way up to the flood were seeing rainbows. Now, give me a second reason. What did God say about the rainbow to Noah? Yeah.
Well, God takes things that people were used to and used to reflect on to declare his promises.
Right. Carol got it. Did y'all hear that? In other words, the rainbow was the sign of a covenant between God and humanity. And you'll see several of those covenants throughout the Old Testament. And every time God makes a covenant with humanity, he always signs it. But he signs it with something familiar from the natural realm. And so the rainbow is basically saying, all those rainbows you've been seeing, from now on when you see a rainbow, that's a sign of the covenant promise I'm making with you. So Noah was not the first to see rainbows. That was simply the first time that rainbows became a sign of the covenant agreement that God made with humanity. Okay, last trivia question. What was the covenant?
He never destroyed the world.
With water.
And with water.
We'd never again destroy the world with water. But he will destroy the world one more time, but not with water, but with
fire.
Good. And those of you who are physicists who know that if you ever to collapse a universe into a singularity, whole universe disappears from existence in a fiery heat. In fact, there's three passages in Scripture which make the point that the universe will end by God wrapping it all up like you wrap up a scroll, and it'll disappear in a fiery heat. And there's actually models of the universe, Big Bang models of the universe, that predict that the universe indeed will end in that very way. Yes. Well, it says there was a mist that came out over the garden.
Oh, and you're saying that mist was rain. Yes.
Well, the two words are ed and matar.
Uh-huh.
And one of the words is referring to relatively large drops of water in the sky. Uh-huh. In other words, just a very fine or very tiny drops of water. Either way, you get a rainbow.
Even with a mist, you
would get a rainbow. Right. I'm really impressed. Here's a woman, obviously over the age of 40, who's using an iPhone to read her Bible. And I love that. Because the wonderful thing is, for free, you can get two different translations of the Bible totally loaded on your phone. So wherever you go, you got your Bible. And if you need glasses, no problem. You just make the print bigger. It's real easy. You know, sometimes I want to do that with my Bible. I just can't enlarge the print. So, but with an iPhone, you can do all that. So, and it's interesting. Often I'm speaking in churches, and everybody's looking at their iPhones. So, anyway, a couple of scientific discoveries before we jump back into Proverbs 8. If I can find my notes here, what happened? Well, maybe I won't be talking about scientific discoveries. Ah. My Bible calling. Here we go. Well, this is actually relevant to what we've been talking about in class. Remember, we've been talking about how we live in this amazing ice age cycle, where the ice age cycle is about 100,000 years. Let me see if I can bring this up for you, just to review again what we're talking about. Yeah, here we go. This is the last ice age cycle. And it's about 100,000 years where you get a warm period that's very brief, and then you drop into an ice age that lasts roughly 90,000 years. Then the temperature goes back up, and you got another warm interglacial. And the warm interglacial lasts about 10,000 years. Okay, a paper got published in Science, one of the world's leading scientific journals, making the point that new measurements, basically measurements of certain isotopes in ocean currents, establish that the ice age cycle changed about 900,000 years ago. 900,000 years ago, the ice age was 41,000 years in duration. So starting 900,000 years ago, it transitioned from a 41,000-year cycle to a 100,000-year cycle. Now, we know just from the Milankovitch cycles that that happens on a regular basis, where we go from a 41,000-year cycle to a 100,000-year cycle. Why? It's because the 100,000-year cycle is driven by the eccentricity in Earth's orbit. I mean, our orbit is roughly circular, but all orbits of planets are elliptical. But the ellipticity of our orbit varies over a 100,000-year cycle. So when the ellipticity is more extreme, this will generate an ice age. When it's less extreme, you're more likely to get a warm interglacial. However, that's only one cycle. A second cycle is that the tilt of the Earth's orbit relative to the plane of the solar system, what's called the obliquity, that also changes. And so that has a 41,000-year cycle. And then there's a third cycle, which is the wobble of the Earth's rotation axis, which is 26,000 years, which explains why the North Star will not be the North Star for a whole lot longer. 13,000 years from now, Vega will be the North Star. So it'll be a lot brighter, so make it a little easier to line up your telescopes, but that'll be 13,000 years from now. But for a long time, our ice ages were 41,000 years, not 100,000 years. And what these isotope analysis was able to show us was that when it was 41,000 years, the ice age was such that... let me just make sure I get this right. Yeah, it generated much thicker ice sheets in the north latitudes, which meant that there was less habitable land during the warm interglacials, because that very thick ice would still be melting during the warm interglacial. The warm interglacial wouldn't last 10,000 years. It'd be much briefer than that. And therefore, if you want to have humans with civilization and a high population, you really want to be in the 100,000-year cycle. If you're in the 41,000-year cycle, then the ice in the north, well, in other words, forget about trying to live in Canada or Russia, the ice is going to be thick there all the time. And but when it switched over to a 100,000-year cycle, this allowed the heavy ice sheets that would accumulate over Canada and Siberia to actually completely melt away during the warm interglacial. And that allows us to have a significant population of civilization there. And moreover, you mentioned, well, I'll show you this slide as well. One of the benefits of an ice age is you wind up with a whole lot of valuable minerals that are easy to mine. Let me pull this up here for you. This shows the growth of minerals throughout Earth's history. When the solar system was forming, there were only 12 minerals on the Earth. And then as the meteorites began to accumulate on the Earth, it jumped up to 60 minerals. And then once the Earth was fully formed, with the next generation of meteorite accumulation, it went to 250. And then life, the origin of life on planet Earth 3.8 billion years ago, life is a tremendous stimulus for the generation of exotic minerals. And that jumped up to 1,500. But to get it up to 4,300, we needed oxygenation events and ice ages, and we needed animal life and vascular plants. That jumped it up to 4,300. But every time you got an ice age, what it does is it exposes minerals that are very helpful for launching, sustaining civilization. There's a good reason why Canada and Siberia are so mineral rich. It's thanks to the last ice age that, minerals are there for exploitation. And so you really do want the ice to melt away sufficiently that you can get at that stuff. And thanks to the 100,000-year cycle, we're there. But what really got the community of scientists excited about this study was that they discovered that the transition from the 41,000-year cycle to the 100,000-year cycle in this particular instance was unique, and it drew down a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And that drawdown of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is what enables the warm interglacial not to be so warm. And that may actually explain. Remember, we were talking about the fact that in the last warm interglacial, you've got what's called this warm spring. That instead of the ice age popping up to a high temperature and then quickly dropping down, it popped up to about 4 degrees centigrade below the typical maximum, and basically it's been stuck there for the last 9,000 years. And as we've discussed in this class, that particular temperature is the optimal temperature for sustaining global high-technology civilization with a high population. Is it just an accident or a coincidence we have this ideal temperature for 9,000 years? I'd say no. Scientists have been struggling trying to find an answer to why this is the case, but this may give us a little bit of insight that perhaps the drawdown of carbon dioxide is one of the features that prevented the temperature from skyrocketing up to a point where it would drop us into another ice age. The evidence is there. They still don't know why this transition was responsible for pulling carbon dioxide out. The other thing they're trying to study is why this transition had such a dramatic impact of limiting the buildup of the ice sheet in the north latitudes, high north latitudes, during the ice age. But clearly, we are the beneficiaries of this. And the apologetic point I'm making here, it's no accident that God placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden at the time that he did, taking advantage of the fact that this transition had been finished, and now we've got these optimal ice ages, and then it's all set up for us to take advantage of this particular ice age, where, you know, I would put Adam and Eve's creation somewhere in this region here, and then look what happens once we start coming out of the ice age. You get the Neolithic Revolution. Neolithic Revolution, 12,000 years ago, occurred right about here, and then we move up to a point where you can get global civilization. Neolithic Revolution basically dramatically launched civilization in the relatively low northern latitudes. But as the Neolithic Revolution grabbed hold, then population began to increase, and then we began to be able to take advantage of that optimal temperature and spread civilization over the whole of the planet. This got published just a couple of days ago in Science. Yes?
How does this placement of Adam and Eve comport with the idea that, I guess a fairly recent idea, that Adam and Eve were quite a bit further back in time, 10,000 to 50,000 years, roughly?
Well, I'm okay with Adam and Eve being back, say, 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 years. There is some new data suggesting, based on the mitochondrial DNA, that maybe the first woman lived 240,000 years ago, but the error bar on that is plus or minus 300,000 years. So, and none of the error bars in terms of trying to scientifically date the first man and the first woman are very accurate. I mean, we're basically looking at best about 50% uncertainty in that date. So, for example, there's some people who are saying maybe we should be pushing it back 90,000 years because that's when we've got archaeological artifacts in some caves in South Africa that indicate that we're looking at a level of tool technology considerably more advanced than what Neanderthals had. So maybe those are the first humans. However, one important proviso on that. Everywhere else in the world where we have similar relics, the dates are coming in at about 40 to 50,000 years. And all of these dates are based on optical luminescence or thermoluminescence, which basically gives you an upper limit. It could be that or a lot less. So the fact that in South Africa we've got dates that are about 50,000 years earlier than everywhere else, you know, means that maybe we need to be cautious about putting too much significance on the South African dates. It is anomalous compared to everything else that looks about the same. And you'd expect with the launch of human beings that you're not going to get huge technology differences between one group of humans and another group of humans. Now, just to give you an idea of how this can be uncertain, there was a famous cave in Australia, the Jimnian Cave, where they used optical luminescence to determine that the Aborigines had made it to Australia 60,000 years ago. But a few years ago, and that, by the way, was quite disturbing because the Great Migration had been dated by everybody else to have taken place about 40 to 45,000 years. So why is humanity going from one locale as far away as Australia 60,000 years ago? But in that Jimnian Cave, they found some carbon on the relics. And so they were able to use carbon-14 dating to come up with a more accurate date for the relics 3,000 years ago. So the dates were literally off by a factor of 20 times. And, you know, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, when my sons were young, I put on their ceiling the Big Dipper and the North Star because I wanted them to be able to figure out, you know, if they're lost somewhere and it's nighttime, they could figure out what direction north was. So I actually put it on their bedroom ceiling. And it was these phosphorescent stars. So if you flick on the light and turn the light off, they glow in the dark. But at another motive, I wanted to know whether or not that they were reading after I turned the lights off. You know, it's bedtime, time to go to sleep. But they would flick their light on and do a little bit of reading. All I had to do is go into the room. If I could see the stars, I knew what was going on. So, but the other thing is, they quickly caught on, and what they figured out is that they actually used a flashlight. There wouldn't be enough illumination to light the stars. And that kind of makes the principle here. The date you get with optical or thermoluminescence depends on the intensity of the light, the intensity of the heat, and also whether or not you got a lot of cloud conditions taking place, or whether the configuration of the cave has changed over time where it lets more light in or less light in. And so that's why you can't put too much significance on these dates concerning when the first humans were here. By the way, the same thing's true when you try to establish a biblical date for Adam and Eve. What you'll see in our material at Reasons to Believe and in the Navigating Genesis book is we attempt a crude calibration based on the genealogies in the Bible as to when Noah lived and when God created Adam and Eve. But as you'll see there, we think those dates are no better than about a factor of two, which is about roughly how good the scientific dates are. So they agree, right? But of course, we'd like to nail down a lot more precision, but it's just simply not available now. Okay, where was I? We were talking about ice ages. I think we're done with that. And let me actually jump into the text here. So,
Proverbs 8.
That's right. Thank you. Okay, let me just read the text. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs overflowing with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the world, or its fields, or any of the dust of the earth, I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed security the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his control, and when he marked out the foundations of the earth. There I was, the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. Now then, my children, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not disregard it. Blessed are those who listen to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. For those who find me find life and receive favor from the Lord. But those who fail to find me harm themselves, and all who hate me love death. Now, a lot of you know I'm working on a book talking about the history of life and what had to be done in order to get the world ready for life. It's kind of like what you see here in Proverbs 8. It's describing for us everything that needs to be put into place by God in order to get the earth ready for human beings and the redemption that God had planned before he created anything. Again, I'll remind you of those passages in Titus and Timothy that makes the point that before God created anything, he had already laid out in detail his plan of redemption. And so the whole goal is to get things ready for human beings in order that God could complete his redemptive plan. So what do we need to get things ready for human beings? Well, what caught my attention in this particular passage is a statement. There was a time when the earth had no oceans. There was a time when it had no mountains and no hills. And this is something that planetary scientists have recently discovered. I made a brief reference to this a couple of months ago in the class, and I just finished writing the chapter on this for my next book, namely that we now know enough about the moon formation event that when the moon was finally finished as a result of a planet twice the size of Mars colliding with the early Earth, they actually got a name for this planet, they call it Theia. When Theia collided with the Earth, that actually did several things to the Earth, increased its mass, infused iron and a sulfur into its core, infused it with uranium and a thorium. All this was crucial in order to make continents possible. Without the moon-forming event, our planet would have never had the plate tectonics that would have generated continents. And notice that's mentioned here, before the hills, before the mountains were put into place. But also says there was a time when our planet was dry. And that's the latest result that's come out of these new moon formation models. They used to think that with a planet, say, only the size of Mars colliding with the Earth, that the Earth might actually retain some of its primordial water. They now know that the moon formation event caused the Earth to be completely dry. All the water was gone. All the atmosphere was gone. So what you basically got is a naked core. No atmosphere, no water. All that was obliterated into outer space as a result of the collision event. Now, how much water did the Earth have before the collision event? Well, the moon-forming models tell us that the primordial Earth must have had an ocean at least 1,000 kilometers deep. And that's a lot deeper than what we've got now. I mean, what's the average depth? About 4 kilometers. And it's only part of the planet. We're talking the entire planet being covered with water about 1,000 kilometers deep. That's necessary in order for Theia colliding into the Earth not to destroy the Earth. But they also realize with Theia colliding into the Earth with that much water, it turns all that water into supersaturated steam and really causes the water and the atmosphere of the Earth to explode away from the Earth. It's like a giant explosion. All the heavy stuff is kept. All the water gets exploded away. All the atmosphere gets exploded away. And so here we have the Earth and the Moon nicely in place. Earth has no atmosphere, no water. Now, what's also come about through these latest models, and if you want to read about them, they're all published in Nature about 4 months ago. If you want to find them, they're up on our website. You'll see an article I've written about these new models. What they've now recognized is there's something called the late veneer that shortly after the formation of the moon basically brings water and an atmosphere to the Earth, but a much thinner atmosphere than it had in the first place and a much thinner layer of water, basically a layer of water that's the optimal depth for the future entrance of human beings. Now, yes?
What was the date of the collision?
The date of the collision? Oh, it had been about 4.47 billion years ago. So when the Earth was about 100 million years old, that's when the collision took place. Well, that's an important point, because what scientists have now recognized, with a collision happening that early, there will still be a remaining veneer of small planetesimals in the Earth, in the inner solar system. You know, today the comet and asteroid belts are out beyond the orbit of Mars. The main belts between Mars and Jupiter, it's the smallest of the five asteroid belts that we have. There are four bigger ones that are beyond the orbit of Saturn. The biggest ones are actually beyond the orbit of Neptune. But with the moon-forming event just finished, there is still a thin veneer of comets and asteroids that are in the vicinity of Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury. And it's that late veneer that basically gives Earth the water and the atmosphere. Matter of fact, one reason why they're establishing a date of 100 to 120 million years after the formation of the Earth for the formation of the Moon, that's when you get the right density of that late veneer to explain our atmosphere and our water. So it's another fine-tuning thing. You want the moon-forming event taking place at a moment when that veneer has just the right constituency and the right size to replace the water and the atmosphere that we lost. But of course, it only replaces a tiny percentage of it. Yes?
Is it possible to use water and material that we lost at the collision, as it went out into interstellar space, could it have come back and been part of the late veneer?
Well, that was the original model when they didn't really know much about that late veneer. They said maybe the water that we have is water that returned. You blast it away, but the gravity of the Earth would bring it back. recognizing now that the planet that collided with the Earth was at least twice the size of Mars, some calculate three or four times the size of Mars, with a planet that big, the water doesn't come back. The atmosphere doesn't come back. It's the late veneer, millions of years later, that brings the water and the atmosphere that we now have. So, something else you can thank God for when you celebrate your Thanksgiving dinner. Probably never done this before, but thank God for that late veneer. Yes. Well, yeah, there's some discussion going on in the planetary science community how much water today we get from comets, because we get bombarded by microcomets literally on an hourly basis. And, you know, comets are 80 to 85% frozen water, so we actually get an ongoing delivery of water. However, it does have a different ratio of deuterium to hydrogen than the water we see in the ocean. And so there have been people saying that given, by the way, I should tell you what deuterium is. Deuterium is heavy hydrogen. Hydrogen that we're typically used to is just a single proton. But if you get a proton and a neutron joined to it, we call that heavy hydrogen or deuterium. And water in different parts of the solar system will have a different ratio of simple hydrogen to heavy hydrogen. And what we notice is that the water in comets does have a distinct difference in that hydrogen to deuterium ratio than the waters we see in the oceans of the Earth, which is one reason why astronomers have concluded the water we have couldn't have come from the comets that currently are orbiting around. This is why they're kind of going back to that late veneer. And moreover, the water, based on what we know about the history of the Earth, would have had to come early. It's not something that kind of dribbled in over a long period of time. It got deposited on the Earth relatively quickly, within a few million years after the moon-forming event.
Does the moon corroborate in that record?
Well, there's still quite a bit of debate in the scientific literature about what they call the deuterium problem and also whether or not the deuterium problem even exists. So, because, you know, it's difficult to measure with any degree of precision what that ratio is. We see that ratio varying over parts of the solar system. So, yeah, there's some astronomers that even doubt that we have a deuterium problem. We may not. And so that's why some people are thinking, well, maybe the late veneer didn't deliver everything. There's also some astronomers that have been pointing out, you know, that the Earth actually loses water very slowly. Because the gravity of the Earth is barely strong enough to hold on to water. So it's a very slow loss of water. And maybe the delivery of these microcomets is actually replacing the water that we lose. Other astronomers are saying, no, we're basically losing water at a slow rate. And if we wait long enough, we're going to lose some more water. But the loss that we have is quite tiny. And again, that's open to debate. Is it being, most astronomers believe that the water we're losing is being balanced by the water we get from the comets. But it's not a lot of water, and it's not a lot as to really solve the deuterium problem. It won't make that much of a difference. Yes?
The late veneer planetesimal, they brought both the atmosphere and the water?
Right, because these planetesimals would be predominantly comet-like material. You know, and comets are almost essentially called volatiles or frozen ices. And so that would deliver carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and water, and methane to the Earth. And so that would explain both our atmosphere and our liquid water ocean. So, yes?
Why would there be a difference in the
Well, again, that's an open question in the astronomical literature as to what's going on with deuterium. Another thing is they're actually looking at the deuterium to hydrogen ratio in different stars. So there's a whole team of astronomers trying to figure out, number one, are there deuterium anomalies in our galaxy, the universe, in our solar system? And if there are, how do we resolve them? So I'm not trying to give you a definitive answer on it because it doesn't exist yet. So that's why you got to keep employing all these astronomers that live here in Southern California. And by the way, you may not know this, you're living in the densest region of the world in terms of astronomers per capita. Yeah, really. Well, I mean, you got Caltech, you got UCLA, you got UC Irvine, JPL. UC Santa Barbara, JPL. Yeah, I mean, you got a lot of places that hire astronomers all right here in Southern California. By the way, that's one reason why I left Canada to come here. I knew that this place was a mecca for astronomy and physics, so plus you got a great climate. So, yes.
Not to obfuscate or complicate, but it makes me wonder, maybe a correlation, even though it's still very open, and iridium versus deuterium deposits. Of course, one is deposited as a solid, and the other one is gaseous. Could other old bodies like Lake Biofuel?
Can you give me those chemicals? I didn't quite hear that.
Iridium?
Oh, iridium, yes.
The high
right.
Depository evidence. Well, not necessarily comet, meteorite.
More likely asteroids. Yeah, iridium is a signature for an asteroidal bombardment.
I think we're answering the question. Yeah. The differential there, what gets to the land.
Right. Yeah, deuterium is something that you would see with a cometary delivery. You get an anomaly there. The iridium anomaly is what you get from asteroids. That's one reason why geophysicists are convinced that the event that wiped out the Cretaceous dinosaurs was an asteroid, because they see this iridium anomaly all over the Earth, and they especially see it in a 3,000-mile radius around, radius around that Chicxulub crater site in the Yucatan Peninsula. Runs right through Tennessee. So if you go to Tennessee, you'll actually see the outer ring of the asteroid collision. It made a big crater right there in Yucatan Peninsula, but when it hit, it caused a pile of debris to be sprayed out and landed about 3,000 miles away. So you see some down in Brazil, and you also see some in Tennessee, and the signature you see in Tennessee matches the one you see in Brazil.
And that ridge goes into the ocean.
It goes into the ocean as well. Well, that was a big debate. A lot of people were saying the collision had to take place in the ocean, because we were seeing some isotope ratios that made it look like it was an ocean collision, but then a whole bunch of other people saying, no, we got data that shows it was a land collision. Well, the problem was the crater in the Yucatan Peninsula is 1,000 feet underground. So people had to drill down in that area and actually find the residue of the cratering event. And what they discovered is half of it is on land and half of it is in the ocean, which explains why half the data was oceanic and half the data was land. That only took them 15 years to figure out.
That's so astronomically short time.
Astronomically short time. But in geophysics, that was considered a long time. It literally took a total of 20 years to settle all the controversies over what wiped out the dinosaurs. But now the controversies are gone. Everybody agrees what happened and what took place. And now NASA's worried about maybe another collision like that could happen in the future. The good news is it only happens about every 50 million years. When was the last one? 65 million years ago. However, the good news is it's random. It's not periodic. So it may be another 50 million years before we get hit. Okay, something else we can get out of the text. This is verse 24. When there were no oceans. Now, I remember reading this when I was 17 years of age. And when I was 17, the reigning paradigm in the geophysical literature was the oceans have always been here, virtually in their present state. So I must confess to you, I looked at that and said, I wonder how this is going to turn out. My textbooks say the oceans have always been here. Here's a text in the Bible that says, no oceans. Now, that didn't disturb my confidence that this might be the Word of God, because I realized the conclusion there were no oceans was not based on any substantive data. That was just simply an assumption that the oceans we see have always been here. By the way, at that time, the assumption also was the continents have always been here and the mountains have always been here. But notice this text. Well, notice the text is saying no oceans, no continents, no mountains, no hills. And, you know, when I was 17, I said, I don't know how this is going to play out. However, I realized this was not a provable contradiction. In the sense, there is no proof that the earth had never had or always had oceans and continents and hills and mountains. And I did not become a Christian until I was 19. And it's when I was 18 and 19, I took a course from two of the three geophysicists that launched plate tectonics. That's where plate tectonics came from. Canadian geophysicists launched it. So I got to take a course from two of the three. And they kind of laid out their theory. And they basically said, our plate tectonics theory is not yet established. We think it's right. Here's why we think it is right. So I was taking furious notes, but also checking my Bible and saying, maybe this text has validity after all. And today, it's been completely vindicated. We do know that the oceans haven't always been here. But something else, it says no hills, no mountains, and also it's inferring no continents. And we get that from Genesis 1. By the way, this is reflecting on Genesis 1. Remember we said there are three biblical texts that take you through the content of the creation events of the six creation days. One is Psalm 104. One is Job 37, 38, and 39. The third one here is of Proverbs 8. And so all of these texts are meant to be integrated to give us a fuller understanding of what Genesis 1 is speaking. But Genesis 1, verse 2 tells us that there is a time when water covered the whole surface of the earth. So that's the text you can go to say there were no mountains. Also, you'll see the text that we studied and went through the book of Job making the same claim. Now, what's interesting is if you don't have water of a particular temperature and a particular depth, it's not going to ignite the plate tectonics that's going to give you the continents. So you need the oceans first. If you got this water layer over the course of the earth, then you have a possibility of getting the plate tectonics that's necessary to establish the continents. But one of the things I'm putting in my book is that earth had no stable continents until the origin of life. And this is brand new material, literally discovered just in the past few months. If you want to sustain tectonics on the earth, it can only happen if you got life. And so the origin of life on planet Earth is now dated to be the same time as the origin of the development of stable continents. Now, yes?
What do you mean by stable?
Okay. You could have a volcanic island that will pop up, but it'll get eroded down and disappear. And so that's unstable tectonics. And Earth did have tectonics before it had life, but it didn't have the kind of aggressive tectonics that would allow a landmass to pop up above the surface of the water and stay there. But there was enough tectonic activity that you would get the occasional temporary volcanic island. So that was going on probably back to about 4.2, 4.3 billion years ago. But 3.85 billion years ago is when we see the first evidence for landmasses that actually remain. But that 3.85 billion years ago is also the time when you see what are called black shales. Now, the only way you can get black shales is if you got life-driving carbon into the shales. And so there's one reason why the date for the origin of life has been pushed back. When we wrote our book, Origins of Life, Buzz Ron and I, back in 2004, we said 3.80 billion years ago for the origin of life. The latest research is saying 3.83 to 3.85. A team in Denmark is saying definitely 3.85 because we have evidence for extensive black shales. And to get those black shales, you need anoxic photosynthetic life. Now, that's interesting because anoxic photosynthetic life is complex bacteria. We're not talking bacteria with only 1,500 gene products. We're talking bacteria with thousands of gene products. And that anoxic photosynthetic life would have to be quite abundant in order to get the black shales. In fact, that Danish team is saying you need at least two different genera of these bacteria in order to get the two different kinds of black shale that we see. But what the benefit of this black shale is, it's not only loaded with carbon. Thanks to life, you get a dose of uranium shot into that shale. And it's light, and that's why they say it has to be anoxic photosynthetic light, because the oxygen that's produced by that light actually causes the precipitation of uranium, which gets into that black shale. And you know what uranium is? It's a radiometric isotope. And so what's happening is that heat being released from the black shales actually induces more aggressive plate tectonic activity. But you also need the oceans, because what the oceans do is they actually allow plates to subduct under one another. So one plate can slide under the other if you got water of the right temperature and the right depth. And if you got this black shale being eroded down into that zone of subduction where you get that little heat pulse from the uranium. And why you need the water will react chemically with the basalts on these at the tops of these plate tectonics, and that water chemical reaction makes talc, and it's the talc that allows the plates to slide underneath one another. In fact, what they're now discovering is this is when Earth transitioned from what they called a rigid lid. A rigid lid is where you got plates, but they can't move against one another. You can get a few volcanic islands, but you're not going to get the plates moving against one another. And so it was the origin of life that transitioned our planet from what they call a rigid lid to where we actually got active plates. But it takes both the water and it takes the life to make that happen. And so the fact that water, liquid water, and life has been abundant on planet Earth for the last 3.85 billion years explains why the continents have remained here and keep growing. Because if you don't have the plate tectonics continuing to operate, then the continents will erode away. So, I mean, if you live near Malibu, for example, your expensive beachfront property could quickly become underwater property. In fact, I can guarantee that if you've got property in the cliffs of Malibu, it won't be long before you'll no longer have beachfront property. You'll be in surfing property. So, but likewise here, in the San Gabriel Mountains, your land is actually moving up every year. And so our state of California, in spite of the rather aggressive erosion that's taking place at the ocean, is actually one of the states that's getting bigger. Isn't that encouraging? Actually live in a state that's going to get bigger with respect to time. But this is not the fastest growing state in the Union. The fastest growing states in the Union are Alaska and Hawaii. But it's because of tectonic activity that those states are growing at the rapid rate they are. Now, if you're on the eastern seaboard, your states are getting smaller and smaller with every year that goes by. Yes?
What are the latest figures for how far down toward the 3.85 does the late heavy bombardment get?
Well, the best date we have for when the late heavy bombardment peaked is 3.87 billion years ago. Peaked. Now, how uncertain is that date? That date is good to maybe plus or minus 5 or 10 million years. So they're saying 3.87. It might be 3.8. It's unlikely to be 3.6 because of this very early date. I mean, calculations that were done a few years ago were saying to get from the late heavy bombardment to where life is even conceivable in terms of being abundant on the face of the Earth, you would need 40 million years minimum. Which means that 3.83 billion would be the first time that you could even have abundant bacterial life on the continental land masses. And we have a very secure date that life does indeed date back that far. But as I said, there's this team in Denmark that's trying to push it back to 3.85. And the reason why that's not gaining wide acceptance is because of the late heavy bombardment. We would expect it would take a lot more time for the Earth to cool enough and for the crust to stabilize enough where life could actually persist at a significant abundance level. And so, but if you push the date back to 3.8, that gives you 30 million years instead of 20 million years, you might be able to make that work. I can't be any more definitive than that. They're still working out the models.
Well,
All right. Yes. We do know that there are other bodies in the solar system that had plate tectonics. Venus had a brief episode of plate tectonics. Mars also may have had a brief episode. That's not positive, but it may have had a brief episode of a plate tectonics. And it's not that difficult to get plate tectonics on a rocky planet. The difficult thing is to get it to stay. I mean, it's easy to have, say, a few hundred thousand years of plate tectonic activity, and you go to what's called a rigid lid. And that's what happened to Venus. It had a brief episode of plate tectonics. Some planetary scientists think that Venus may have had three or four brief episodes, but they're very brief, and the predominant picture is stagnant lid. Earth is the only body we know of where we have sustained plate tectonics. Now, I'm writing this up in my book as well. What are the chances of getting sustained plate tectonics on an exoplanet? And what's interesting is they've discovered that as the planet gets more massive, you know, if the rocky planet gets more massive, then the probability of getting sustained plate tectonics goes down. If it's less massive, it also goes down. In fact, if it's less massive than even 1%, you've got no chance for sustained plate tectonics, no matter how much water and the life you might have. So it's showing that the Earth's mass must be fine-tuned in order to have a chance of sustained plate tectonics. But I think what's most exciting is the recognition, if you don't have abundant life, you're not going to keep it up. And so life needs plate tectonics to be sustained. But plate tectonics needs life to be sustained. It's actually a synergistic relationship. Say, why do we need the plate tectonics? Without the plate tectonics, there won't be a mechanism to change the atmosphere of the Earth step by step over time to compensate for the brightening of the sun. Plate tectonics, if it's sustained, will remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. By the way, you have to fine-tune the plate tectonics because some plate tectonics actually go the other way. So, for example, if your plate tectonics is only making volcanoes as opposed to plate subduction, all you got is volcanic activity, then you could have a situation where the volcanoes are putting out sulfur aerosols. Sulfur aerosols cool the planet. They actually make the planet colder. And then if you release carbon dioxide, and there's lots of volcanoes that do that. They don't put out much sulfur, but they release a lot of carbon dioxide. That's the case when you go to Mammoth. Mammoth is a volcano, and there are gases being emitted up there at Mammoth, but it's carbon dioxide. And I can tell you, if you ever take a vacation at Mammoth, and a lot of you do, if you see a big bare patch of ground where nothing is growing, walk around it. Don't walk through it. That's a place where carbon dioxide is being emitted. And people have actually been killed at Mammoth for going into the wrong place. By the way, that's never happened in summer, but it has happened in winter where you can't tell where the bare ground is. So people have actually skied over one of these places where carbon dioxide is being emitted. Carbon dioxide isn't poisonous, but it's heavy. It stays close to the ground, and what it does is it cuts out the oxygen. And so you wind up breathing carbon dioxide. You think, you know, it's odorless, but actually three skiers got killed a few years ago skiing across one of those carbon dioxide emissions off of the... So, with carbon dioxide, that's going to warm the planet. If it's sulfur aerosols, it'll cool the planet. But if you really want to compensate for the brightening of the sun, you need not only volcanic activity, you really need aggressive plate tectonics where efficient subduction is taking place. And I'm not going to bore you with the chemistry again. I've done that twice in the class already, showing you how plate tectonic activity... If you've got the right kind of water cycle, and notice this text mentions rain, you've got to have rain. It takes rain falling on exposed continents, and that rain acts as a catalyst that generates a chemical reaction that transforms the silicates in the continents into carbonates and sand. But the net result is carbon dioxide's pulled into the atmosphere. So water falling on kind of the land masses, and by the way, it's got to be the right kind of rain. The right kind of rain falling on the continental land masses will cause carbon dioxide to react with the silicates and make carbonates and sand. And by the way, we're the beneficiaries. Silicate is not a useful industrial material, but sand is and carbonates are. So next time you drive the freeways, that's sand and carbonates that you're driving over. So that's something else you can thank God for come Thanksgiving. Thank God for this plate tectonic activity that converted the silicates into these industrial materials of sand and carbonates that we're able to exploit. But at the same time, the removal of that carbon dioxide means that as the sun gets progressively brighter and brighter, our atmosphere becomes progressively less and less efficient to trap heat that's coming out of the sun. And that's why this is such an exciting discovery I talked about, where we switch from a 41,000-year ice age cycle to a 100,000-year ice age cycle, because what that did is it pulled a significant amount of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So as the sun is brighter, we don't wind up with a situation where we have no ice ages at all. By the way, we're on the hairy edge. It won't be long, in terms of the history of the Earth, before there's no ice ages at all. And that would not be a good place to be, in terms of being able to sustain civilization.
That would be when the universe would be burned up.
Well, it might happen before that. We'll see. Yeah, go ahead.
The fact that we have a molten core in our planet, first of all, does that have a lot to do with the...
It does.
I would think so. Have we found exoplanets that have molten cores? I would expect all of them to have the same cores that we do, more or less.
Well, that's actually another discovery I could talk to you about. Got published just this week as well, where they're trying to get at the core issue of these exoplanets. What kind of cores do they have? And to really get a good handle on that, we need an accurate measure of the radius or the diameter of the exoplanet. And with current technology, that's not been forthcoming. But there's a new technique that's just been used, just published in the Astrophysical Journal, where for the first time, they measured the diameter of a rocky planet to 1% precision. If we can measure it to 1% precision, we can get an idea of what's going on in the core. But if you look at the literature, what they're saying is that it really looks like the Earth has a unique core. In this sense, we have a solid inner core that's surrounded by a liquid core. And the reason why we have that is because of the late heavy bombardment and the late veneer and the moon forming event, our core has a unique chemical composition. You have to fine tune the quantity of uranium, thorium, iron, sulfur, and oxygen at different points in the solid core and the liquid core in order to establish sufficient movement in that liquid core that you generate a strong magnetic field. And to a lesser degree, it has an impact on the plate tectonics.
Kind of like currents.
Right. I mean, it's like a dynamo. I mean, if you've got, ferrous metals sloshing around in that liquid core, that's inside that you've got a solid core that sets up a circulation that establishes the strong magnetic field. And for advanced light to be possible, we need both the plate tectonics and we need that strong magnetic field. If it wasn't for that strong magnetic field, that atmosphere we got blessed with at the late veneer would be gone. Radiation from the sun would sputter away our atmosphere. What prevents that from happening is the fact that we've had a strong magnetic field for the last, 4 billion years. So the atmosphere we got from the late veneer, we got to keep it. But without that liquid core surrounding the inner core, that wouldn't happen. And the models that physicists have been doing on the interior of rocky planets has strongly suggested that this may be unique to the Earth. Yes, exoplanets certainly have cores, but probably not a core morphology like we see here on planet Earth, and particularly given how small our planet is. So that's where it stands now. However, we may be getting a lot more insight on that if we can come up with measurements of the diameters of, say, a few hundred rocky planets to 1% precision. Yes?
Our system
exoplanet Venus obviously had a liquid core like that, but it died out very quickly. That would be the normal pattern, which would be to have a molten core with a kind of form and for it to cool pretty quickly like Venus, right?
Yeah, it cooled quickly, and so we know Venus doesn't have a core structure like the Earth. So
and the second part, on plate tectonics, obviously, is that's also an important recycling event. You know, I've had people climb mountains and come back and tell me, you know, look, I found a seashell on the top of a 10,000 foot mountain. I'm like, well, that's because it used to be on the bottom of the ocean floor for recycling of nutrients when you plate tectonics. Otherwise, it would be a dead planet, too.
Right. Yeah, whenever continents collide, they make mountains. So the Himalayas are the direct result of the Indian subcontinent splitting off from Antarctica, heading north at a high speed, colliding with Asia and generating the Himalayas. And by the way, the collision is still ongoing. It's going to take another 10 million years for that collision to peter out. So the Himalayas will one day be higher than 30,000 feet.
It used to be at the bottom of the Indian Ocean.
Used to be at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. And so, yeah, if you go into the Himalayas, you see seashells everywhere. It's crumpled up seafloor. So we don't have that here, but if you go to the Grand Canyon, you'll see lots of seashells on the top of the Grand Canyon. Yes?
You also find seashells on the bookie houses of
Colorado. Oh, you do? Okay. So, anyway, amazing planet in which we live. I got, 5 minutes to go? You want me to wrap things up? Okay, we'll terminate the questions. So, back to the text here. I was appointed from eternity before the world began. In other words, long before the world began, this plan of creation was laid out. But the point I want to make here as we go through these texts, when there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs overflowing with water. Now, the springs overflowing, we haven't gotten into this point yet, and I guess I'm not going to have time to cover this. But the fact that we have this plate tectonic activity goes on means that water on the surface of the Earth is being driven into the interior of the Earth. And incidentally, we now know that the surface water of the Earth was at least 26% greater than it is today. Say, what happened to that 26%? It's been driven into the upper mantle. And so what's unique about the Earth is we have a wet mantle. Now, this got all kinds of play on the internet just a few weeks ago. A lot of confusion.
Where it was the sail there, you know?
Yeah, people wanted to know if they could surf that water in the mantle. people got the idea that it was actually some kind of liquid water lake that sat in the mantle. Well, if you know a little bit about the geophysics of the Earth, it's way too warm for there to be liquid water in the mantle. We're talking, you know, many hundreds of degrees of centigrade. But what they meant by water in the mantle, they meant hydrates. Hydrate is a term for a mineral that's been joined with water to make another kind of mineral. And so what they've been discovering is that in the upper mantle of the Earth are all these hydrated minerals. But what those hydrated minerals do is they change the viscosity of the upper mantle. And by changing the viscosity, it actually allows the plates to move more efficiently under and over one another. So without a wet mantle, you're not going to be able to sustain the tectonic activity at the level it's necessary to keep the continents growing. By the way, we are living on a planet where the continents are getting bigger. And again, this is off topic, but when I debated Peter Ward at the University of Washington, his comment was, he was an atheist, but the point he kept making throughout the debate is, we have 29% coverage of planet Earth with continental land masses right now. When it hits 30%, we're doomed. And so it's only a matter of time before it hits 30%. Now, if you're worried about your investment portfolio, he was talking millions of years. It'll take many millions of years before it hits 30%. But he did make an interesting point, that when you change the continental landmass coverage from, say, 27% to 28% to 29% to 30%, it changes the chemical balance of the entire surface of the Earth, both the oceans and the continents, because there's these recycling mechanisms that are going on. And basically it was making a point that what we've seen over the last half billion years is that erosion has not kept pace with the plate tectonics. Now, both the erosion rate is going down and the tectonic activity is going down, but it is such that tectonics is slightly winning, which means it is inevitable we're going to get to 30%. But isn't it wonderful that God put us human beings on planet Earth when it's 29%? And that was the point that Peter Ward and I agreed on. We humans are here at the ideal continental landmass coverage. And maybe that's a good point to stop for prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for these amazing insights we see in these creation texts in your word. Lord, how they're being confirmed by the latest scientific research, how the book of nature is showing us miracles of creation we've never been able to appreciate before. And Father, I pray that that would allow us to recognize the glory of creation like we've never had before. And Father, I pray too that you would give us the grace, the humility, and the wisdom to be able to communicate this to people who don't yet know you as Creator, Lord, and Savior, that they too may join us in a new creation once this universe has fulfilled its purpose. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.